Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Kripko, and I'll be going over 5 recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on, but either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top 5 countdown for the week. At number 5, we have Google's plan to develop robot reporters capable of churning out 30,000 articles a month. Sputnik published an article over the weekend about how the Silicon Valley tech leader gave the UK Press Association $800,000 as part of Google's 3-year, $170 million digital news initiative, which includes, as one of its many goals, the creation of automated, or robot-written, news. This specific program is formerly known as Reporters and Data and Robots, or RADAR. And according to what was written about it, Google's planned robot reporters will rely on open sources such as government and police departments to generate reports that they'll then send on to other media outlets for proliferation or to provide the basis for human-written articles. There are a lot of technical details about how this will work, but that's not what I'm interested in discussing today. Instead, I'd like to take a look at the pros and cons of the system and assess the impact that is poised to have on the international media and the global information space in general. On the positive side of things, RADAR could be very useful as a news aggregator if it succeeds in sourcing information from as many well-known and obscure open sources as it claims it will, especially if it provides an easy-to-use search feature for narrowing results. Moreover, algorithms have already proven themselves impressively capable of identifying far-reaching patterns that human minds can't conceive of on their own because of big data's ability to process millions upon millions of information points, which could be relevant in this context if it's used to regularly produce news reports about the economy, society, and crime. The problem, however, is that the RADAR service might have a prohibitively expensive cost point, which would essentially relegate this de facto newswire service to the domain of mainstream media companies, who could then act as gatekeepers to either disseminate it to the public through their usual filters or resell some of the more targeted raw reports to different clients, which in both cases makes them the information broker between Google and the public. There's also the fact that RADAR's reports in and of themselves might not be as accurate as people expect them to be, because there's a huge difference between compiling facts in an organized form and attempting to extrapolate patterns and analysis from them about any given topic, especially fast-moving international events. Another foreseeable problem is that there's no telling which sources Google won't allow the RADAR program to use, meaning that it could potentially self-censor its reports by avoiding alternative information from Russian and other multipolar media, or dismissively misportraying it and their outlets as propaganda. Overall, Google's entrance into the automated news business speaks to its desire to monopolize this emerging industry and set the company on the path to expanding its ever-growing political power. It already controls the information sphere through its carefully curated search engine, and now it wants to be in charge of how people interpret what they come across through its services as well. This puts the company in the prime position to wield its unparalleled power over human perception as a political tool in the future, whether it's to turn citizens against their governments, interfere in election campaigns, or streamline a global unipolar narrative. The next one up is Al-Shabaab beheading 9 people in a coastal area of Kenya that's supposed to be the staging ground for one of China's most ambitious new Silk Road projects in the region. The scene of this gruesome terrorist attack was Lamu County, a region of Kenya abutting the Somalian border and therefore susceptible to Al-Shabaab's penetration. The group has attacked Kenya several times before in high-profile incidents, but this one is different because of where it took place. Instead of in the much larger city of Garissa or its namesake county where most of these attacks have happened in the past, this one occurred near the small, sleepy fishing village of Lamu that's expected to host China's Lamu Port, South Sudan-Ethiopia Economic Corridor, otherwise known as LAPSEC. This multimodal transport corridor is one of China's chief new Silk Road investments in all of Africa, and aims to create a strategic network linking Kenya with its South Sudanese and Ethiopian neighbors, which is very significant because the last two states are landlocked, though the former has major oil supplies, while the latter is among the fastest-growing economies in the world. China just built the Djibouti Addis Ababa Railroad to connect Ethiopia to the outside world through its tiny coastal neighbor, Djibouti, but the Chinese understand the importance of having a secondary route for reaching this country, especially one which connects the region's two largest economies. As for South Sudan, it's hoped that improving its access to the outside world could help real sector economic and commercial development to seep in and counteract the humanitarian crisis that's exploded there since its still unresolved civil war broke out a few years ago shortly after the country's independence. China is building a military base in Ethiopia's Djibouti choke point and has dispatched peacekeepers to South Sudan, so it's clearly invested in both countries' success, hence the prioritization given to LAPSSET as a complementary vehicle for ensuring their long-term stability. Enter al-Shabaab, which is now threatening the viability of the LAPSSET corridor through its recent terrorist upsurge in Lamu and the enduring danger that it presents to the entire East Kenyan portion of this project. This terrorist group might have arisen due to unique regional conditions, but it nowadays fits into the global strategic model being spearheaded by the U.S., which is to wage identity-centric hybrid wars in geostrategic transit states along China's new Silk Road in order to disrupt, control, or influence these initiatives. Al-Shabaab's latest beheading spree could be seen in this context and analyzed for the effect that it'll have on LAPSSET, as well as the chance that it could serve as an impetus for strengthening the military aspects of the Chinese-Kenyan strategic partnership. There's little doubt that al-Shabaab will remain a constant threat to this project and others so long as it enjoys its Somalian safe havens. So there's a chance that China might press the African Union, and specifically its Kenyan and Ethiopian partners, to once again take the risk and commence military operations there in order to decisively defeat it. In exchange, China could promise that it will come in afterwards and rebuild the country in order to turn it into a key node on the new Silk Road, eventually redeveloping it just like it plans to do with South Sudan through LAPSSET, as a means of giving Somalians their best bet yet for prolonged stability in the 21st century. Third in our countdown is the liberation of Mosul and the uncertain future that awaits Iraq. It's a tremendous step in the war on terror that Mosul was officially declared as liberated over the weekend, and this great but bloody victory will remain in every Iraqi's mind for years to come. The most immediate effect is that the Iraqi army and its ally militias can now concentrate more fully on freeing the underpopulated desert regions of Anbar and Nineveh provinces that are still under Daesh's control, which could complement the ongoing anti-terrorist operations in neighboring Syria and allow both national militaries to jointly wipe this group out of their shared borderland region. Daesh's last stand is quickly shaping up to be in the Euphrates River Valley near Deir ez-Zor, and it'll take the coordinated efforts of Syria and Iraq to wipe this group out once and for all. After it's defeated in the conventional sense, however, it'll probably revert back to its originally insurgent roots, just like many people are predicting. And the case study of al-Qaeda's branch affiliate in Mali in the years following France's 2013 anti-terrorist intervention there are very instructive in hinting at what the future might realistically hold for Daesh in Syrac. The primary difference is that Mali doesn't have the added destabilization factor of roughly 20% of its population pushing forward with an independence referendum in the next few months, like the Kurds are planning to do in Iraq. And this impending vote will certainly disrupt any peaceful post-Daesh settlement in the Mideast country. I explore the consequences of what's to come more in detail during last week's Trendstorm episode titled Iraq, From War on Terror to Civil War, in which I spoke to experts Joe Loria and Engin Ozer about the foreseeable implications of this event. All told, there are four conceivable scenarios that could unfold. Kurdistan could remain part of a federalized Iraq, or it could enjoy a peaceful succession from the state, which are positive but unlikely scenarios. It's more probable that the region's independence will disrupt the delicate balance between Shias and Sunnis in Iraq and herald in a civil war, either between those two sects or also involving the Kurds as well. There's also the chance that the regional powers could unite in waging a coordinated military campaign to prevent Kurdistan from achieving independence, just as they attempted to do against Israel in 1948. These dark scenarios would be devastating for the region, but they're frighteningly real prospects which must be taken seriously by all interested parties and observers. With that in mind, the liberation of Mosul might bring an end to Iraq's war on terror, but it'll probably be the beginning of something much bigger, which could make this landmark event unforgettable for all the wrong reasons. Our runner-up are the multi-billion-dollar gas deals that have already been reached with Iran or are presently being negotiated with it. The French energy giant Total just clinched a 50.1% stake in a $4.8 billion deal to develop Iran's South Pars gas field alongside China and Iran's national energy companies. This represents the first major post-sanctions investment by a Western company, and Reuters quoted experts who analyzed that it could also give France a unique opportunity to expand its investments in neighboring Qatar, which shares the world's largest gas field with Iran and calls its South Pars abutting offshore deposits the North Dome. Qatar, which is already the world's largest LNG exporter, just announced that it wants to increase its gas exports by another 30%, so it'll clearly need some more investment to do that, and France's Total might be the perfect partner for it. While all of this is going on, India also offered $11 billion in what it called its best offer for the Farzad B gas field. Although Iran has yet to accept or decline the deal at the time of this recording, it's nevertheless set the benchmark price that Tehran will eventually receive for this, whether from New Delhi right now or someone else who might come in with a higher offer. Altogether, it can be expected that the LNG price will eventually drop in the future once Iran and Qatar's latest large-scale gas investments hit the market and contribute to a glut. Moreover, Papua New Guinea and Mozambique, both of which have enormous LNG potential, are also supposed to enter the marketplace in the coming years too, as will Russia's own Yamal and Sakhalin LNG projects, all of which will drive down the price for this resource. However, the processing and transport expenses are still unusually high for LNG, so unless the costs fall due to the introduction of some new technology or industrial scaling, then it's almost certain that prices will eventually bottom out at some level or another. The opposite is true for oil, however, because that commodity has a price ceiling which can't be passed without kicking the U.S.'s costly shale gas extraction back into operation and forcing the price back down again. What's most interesting in all of this is that the prices for oil and gas are indexed with one another, so each resource is affected by the price floor and ceiling of the other, despite the opposite dynamics. The oil price is relatively stabilized because of OPEC and the deal that its members and most important partners agreed to last year, but no similar organization or coordination exists between the world's largest natural gas players. So the predictable price glut that's set to hit the LNG marketplace might compel them to form their own gas OPEC and initiate cooperative price-fixing measures with one another. And that's the main takeaway here, folks, is that the multi-billion dollar Iranian gas deals that have been reached or are under negotiation stand to completely upset the market fundamentals for this commodity. And by provoking a glut of LNG, which could crash the price, this might in turn compel the formation of a gas OPEC between Russia, Iran, and Qatar to stabilize it. At our top spot, we've got the Trump Jr. setup scandal and the suspicious timing surrounding its leak to the press. The newest Russiagate story of the week is that Donald Trump Jr. met with Russian lawyer Natalia Veselnitskaya before the election and a couple weeks after his dad won the Republican nomination last summer. This woman ostensibly represents interests opposed to the so-called Magnitsky Act, which sanctions certain Russian officials and is thought to have contributed to Russia's asymmetrical response of banning Americans from adopting Russian children. The initial optics of this arrangement make it seem like Trump Jr. had somewhat secretly met with the woman who, for all intents and purposes, is being painted by the mainstream media as a foreign agent, which in that case would supposedly prove that some kind of connection existed between Trump's presidential campaign and Moscow. Trump Jr., for his part, didn't deny that the meeting took place, but clarified that he had basically been set up because he was promised compromising information on Hillary Clinton and wasn't aware of who his interlocutor would be, implying that he was tricked into attending the brief gathering so that the Democrats could then have so-called evidence to push what would eventually become the fake news narrative about Trump and Russia. Furthermore, The Hill reported that Mark Corallo, a spokesman for Trump's outside counsel, said that Ms. Veselnitskaya employs a private investigator whose firm, Fusion GPS, was responsible for the notoriously discredited Golden Shower dossier at the beginning of this year, and that she and her translator had, quote, misrepresented who they were, end quote. Putting all this together, then it convincingly looks like some sort of setup indeed took place in order to manipulate Trump Jr. into a carefully choreographed situation whose initial optics superficially imply that there was some kind of political tit-for-tat collusion going on between his dad's presidential campaign and Moscow via a woman who is being portrayed by the mainstream media as indirectly representing the Russian government's interests in the U.S. Considering this elaborate setup, and presuming that this is actually what happened, then it raises serious questions about why the Democrats and their deep state backers sat on this information until now. No matter that they knew it was fake, but still understood the explosive effect that it could have on public perception once it was revealed. This shockingly, but unsurprisingly, suggests that the timing behind this latest scandal was predetermined to coincide with the first ever face-to-face meeting between Presidents Putin and Trump in order to undermine whatever they'd achieve, which publicly turned out to be the ceasefire in southwestern Syria and a verbal agreement to cooperate on cybersecurity. The intent was to sow enough doubt in the public's mind over the outcome of their summit that people would think that Trump did whatever Putin wanted because he's either a Kremlin puppet or being blackmailed, neither of which are true, but are convenient for advancing the opposition's weaponized narrative to discredit Trump's presidency. So folks, the next time that you hear about this story, take a second to reflect on what it means that the deep state and their Democrat and mainstream media collaborators hatched such an elaborate plot to undermine democracy by manipulating people's perceptions. Scary stuff. All right, folks, this wraps up this week's edition of Context Countdown, and I want to warmly thank each and every one of you for joining me this week. I'm going to be on break next week, so I'll be back by the end of July. Hope you'll tune in again next time, and talk to you later. Bye.